the practice of meditation, cultivating the mind to grow and develop, is something important in our lives. It consists of wisdom and a proper understanding of the correct path of practice. Some people may like to make the mind calm and still, but do not investigate and look for the truth at all. They will only receive the happiness that comes from samadhi, concentration. But if we have concentration and then use it to contemplate and to see the truth, seeing arising, abiding, and then ceasing, which is the object of insight knowledge, then in this way, wisdom will arise. Venerable Ajahn Chah gave an example. Some kinds of trees have roots in the air, yet they can absorb minerals from the air without needing to be planted in the soil. Therefore, the object of insight is for us to understand anicchang, dukkang, anatta, that is, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. These are the objects of insight. If we practice and truly see the not-self nature of form, the body, physical things, and all material objects, or the natural things that exist, trees, mountains, buildings, houses, whether a pavilion, a temple hall, an ordination hall, or the forms of animals or people, when we truly see not self through knowledge and direct understanding, we will then know it deeply. Scientists also try to investigate and are beginning to discover the truth that what we feel to be ourselves or what we see and experience in reality does not truly exist. It is actually emptiness. But our mind, which still lacks wisdom, is not yet empty. It is still dominated by delusion and remains ignorant. So it believes that these things truly exist. This is the opposite to the Dhamma. Therefore, one does not see the Dhamma and does not see the Buddha's teachings. When one does not see the Dhamma, one is deluded and clings to things, and suffering arises. You can see that tanha, craving, sensual craving, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence, the desire to have, to become, or the desire not to have and not to become, all become causes for suffering to arise. So suffering does not arise randomly. It has causes and conditions. When the causes and conditions cease, the suffering also ceases. This is one pair. The second pair is sila, samadhi, panya, morality, concentration, and wisdom, as we are practicing now, are the causes and conditions for nirodha, cessation, the ending of suffering, to arise. We can end dukkha, suffering, by walking marga, the noble path. But if we have craving, then suffering arises. There's a struggle between them within our minds. When the power of the path becomes strong, it will naturally destroy the defilements. Craving will naturally be abandoned, and suffering will no longer arise. Therefore, these things are Dhamma that arise within our own mind. When we contemplate with wisdom, we can see happiness and suffering. If viewed in one way, they seem different, because we like happiness and dislike suffering. But from the perspective of Dhamma, they are said to have the same value. This is because they exist in a state that is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, without any owner to be found. Venerable Ajahn Chah taught us in this way, so that when we reflect and contemplate it, it becomes clearer. They are samutti, conventional reality. All things are conventions. If we truly see into conventions, then liberation arises. For example, this body is conventionally regarded as us. Whether it is a human, a dog, a cat, or other animals, livestock such as cows and buffalo, they are all considered living beings. There are persons, identities, a self, us, and them. But in the Buddha's teaching, when we contemplate the body, we see that when the mind examines the body itself truly does not exist. When we analyze the body into the 32 parts, and further into the four elements, and examine more subtly, we will see that it is not truly there. Sometimes practitioners may even see it as a flow of earth, water, fire, and wind circulating around. This body is made up of extremely small and subtle components, yet no real self or identity can be found. One sees this clearly. Even scientists may have discovered that it is not truly solid. There is only emptiness within every atom of this body. But the mind, even after learning and understanding this, still clings to it as self, because wisdom has not yet fully arisen. Therefore, we must practice cultivating the mind, as the Buddha taught, to purify the mind. The original mind is luminous, radiant, and bright. But although the mind is clean, it is not yet pure. It is clear, but not pure. It is still mixed with defilements. When there are the internal and external sense bases, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, receiving forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mental objects, then clinging arises. And we must be careful here, because defilements arise where sense contact occurs. Ignorance, craving, and clinging arise, and suffering arises. When we develop mindfulness and wisdom to know this, we can let go at the point of clinging by walking the path, cultivating morality, concentration, and wisdom, and seeing that there is no true self. Now, the practice depends on the accumulated merit and spiritual perfections of each person. Some are skilled in using wisdom and contemplation to bring about calm. Some people do not like that method. They prefer simply repeating Butto, Dhammo, Sangho, using a meditation word alone. They do not like thinking. When the mind becomes calm, they do not like analyzing anything. But when the mind becomes calm, they can realize that there is no self. Those who use wisdom and contemplation can also analyze and understand in the same way, becoming peaceful together with wisdom. These are differences in skills, but both can reach the end of suffering. At the beginning, they may not understand each other, but later they will understand very well that both methods can lead to the end of suffering and to seeing the Dhamma. Both can see conventional reality and liberation. For those who rely mainly on contemplation, wisdom leads and concentration follows. But when concentration reaches its full strength, clear wisdom arises. For those who practice primarily through concentration leads while wisdom is not yet actively used. But when concentration reaches the proper level, they can then apply contemplation continuously. In the end, they realize and understand both conventional truth and liberation. Among the Buddha's disciples, Venerable Mahamoggallana, the chief disciple on the left, and Venerable Sariputta, the chief disciple on the right, had accumulated spiritual perfections equally. However, according to their different dispositions and past aspirations, they had developed their perfections differently. Both had aspired to become chief disciples of the perfectly self-awakened Buddha. Venerable Mahamoggallana was especially skilled in converting those who were stubborn by using psychic powers to subdue their pride and wrong views. For example, there was a certain Brahmin who wanted to eat crispy pancake, but he was extremely stingy. If he prepared them downstairs, he feared he would have to share them with his wife and children. So he thought, "I will make them and eat them alone." He thought to such an extent that, although he was a wealthy man, he went up to the 7th floor of his mansion to cook them. However, his wisdom and spiritual potential were nearing maturity and had come within the knowledge of the Buddha. So the Buddha instructed Venerable Mahamoggallana to fly up and bring this stingy Brahmin to see him at Jetavana Monastery. Venerable Mahamoggallana received this instruction and went there. He hovered outside the window, but the stingy Brahmin paid no attention at all to the monk who had flown there. If it were in this day and age, and a monk could fly like that, I think in the whole of Rayong province and every other town, they would come to see the flying monk. And after watching for a while, people would probably start asking for the 2-digit or 3-digit lottery numbers. Because if someone is that capable, they must surely know something. But this Brahmin did not care at all. This shows just how strong stinginess can be. He thought that eating the pancakes alone was the best thing possible. Nothing could be better than that. Even if monks flew here, he would tell them to go somewhere else. He absolutely would not give these pancakes. He would not give it under any circumstance. I would not pay attention to the monk. If we had faith and saw a monk flying like that, we would probably offer everything. But this Brahmin refused to give anything. Venerable Mahamoggallana used various psychic means to subdue him. When the Brahmin tried to chase him away with smoke, the smoke turned back on him. When he tried to throw fire at the monk, the fire turned back on him. After being subdued in every way, the Brahmin finally surrendered. He could not endure it any longer and decided to give him a little of the pancake so he would leave. But when the Brahmin tried to separate the pancakes, they wouldn't, so in the end, he gave them all. At that moment, his stinginess was finally loosened. But Venerable Mahamoggallana said he couldn't take them. It had to be taken to offer to the Buddha at Jetavana Monastery. The Brahmin said, "I live in Rajagaha. How am I supposed to go all the way to Jetavana Monastery? This is my responsibility." The Brahmin then obediently agreed. The wealthy man came down from the 7th floor to the ground level, and the moment he stepped down, he was already standing in front of Jetavana Monastery. He brought the food to offer to the Buddha, together with more than 500 of his disciples. Now the mind was at ease and joyful, and after listening to the Buddha's Dhamma, he attained stream entry. In this case, it can be said that psychic powers were used to subdue him. Even since the time of the great master, Venerable Ajahn Mun, some of his disciples did not respect him very much. There were learned monks who had passed the Pali scholar examinations. They were very good at their studies, and they thought, "We are highly educated and knowledgeable, more capable than Venerable Ajahn Mun." Out of compassion, Venerable Ajahn Mun went to knock on that monk's dwelling and said, "Scholar monk, don't think like that. It will be bad karma for you." That was enough. The disciple immediately yielded and said, "How did you know?" Similarly, in the case of Venerable Ajahn Chah, there was also a Pali scholar monk, one who had passed the fifth or sixth level of the Pali examinations, named Venerable Maha Bunmi. He was never afraid of anyone. He came to stay at Wat Nong Papong because he wanted to learn from there. He had heard that Ajahn Chah was very knowledgeable and highly capable, knowing everything, and so he came. He sat there thinking about it, and in the evening he went to pay respects to Venerable Ajahn Chah. I myself was nearby fanning Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah then said, "Hey, Maha, you keep sitting there looking at other people. Why don't you look at yourself instead? Do you see me? Do you see my liver, kidneys, intestines, and lungs?" Thereby subduing that monk. The scholar monk was shocked, truly startled. His views and conceit were subdued, and he yielded somewhat. And there was another distinct teaching method. A layperson had come to pay respects to Venerable Ajahn Chah and walked past the dwelling where this scholar monk was staying. Ajahn Chah asked the layperson, "Where did you walk from?" The layperson replied, "I walked from over there, passing by that dwelling." Ajahn Chah said, "Oh, you walked past there. Did you see the tiger? I keep a tiger there. Did you see it?" The layperson answered, "No, I didn't see it." After paying his respects, he took leave of Ajahn Chah, but he became curious and wanted to see the tiger. Ajahn Chah had said he kept a tiger there, yet he hadn't seen it when he passed by. So he kept walking back and forth, circling in front of the dwelling. It was rather strange. Normally, if you don't see something, you just let it go. But this time, even though he hadn't seen it, he kept thinking, "There must be one. I have to see it." Ajahn Chah had spoken truthfully. He wasn't lying. There really was a tiger to be found. But it was not a striped tiger. It was a tiger in a person's heart. The body was human, but the mind was like a tiger. Bold, fearless, unwilling to yield to anyone. Even this scholar monk's Pali name reflected that same fearless character. Then that scholar monk became curious and asked, "Layman, you keep walking back and forth. What are you looking for?" The layman replied, "I came to pay respects to Venerable Ajahn Chah. He told me he keeps a tiger here, but I can't find it. He said it's around this dwelling." When Maha Bunmi heard this, he was so taken aback. "Oh, it's me. I am the tiger. I have never yielded to anyone since I was born." That was all it took, and all his pride and conceit completely collapsed. And later on, he went to establish a monastery. In that village, the place was called something like Tiger Roaring Village, referring to the sound of a tiger's roar. This suggests that perhaps in a past life he had some connection with tigers, which is why in this life his character was so bold and strong. He later told me himself that he had never been afraid of anyone. The only person he ever yielded to was Venerable Ajahn Chah. This was a teaching method used to subdue pride and conceit. Such was the spiritual power of Venerable Ajahn Mun, Venerable Ajahn Chah, and also Venerable Mahamoggallana, the chief disciple. His abilities must have been extraordinary, paired with Venerable Sariputta. We must diligently cultivate meditation and practice the Dhamma. It is something important for our lives. So, during this week of Magga Puja, even though the day itself has already passed, we can still bring these teachings to contemplate and clearly realize them within our own hearts. May you grow in blessings.